How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing so well. I cannot wait for this episode. How are you doing today, Tim?
I'm doing great, Lance. And yeah, this episode we recorded a few weeks ago with our new friend, investigative journalist and author, Shayna Roth. She wrote a great book called Cold Cases. Check it out. We had her on one of our podcasts, Empty Frames, to talk about the Gardner heist. And we also had her live on one of our Getting Vocal nights just a few weeks ago. And this is the episode, the audio that we're going to play right now.
Yeah, super interesting person, very, very talented journalist, very talented writer. You mentioned the book, Cold Cases, a True Crime Collection, Unidentified Serial Killers, Unsolved Kidnappings. She covers, among other crimes, aside from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, the Zodiac Killer, Natalie Holloway, the Golden State Killer. Very good read, and might I say, a Nancy Drew fan. So there, you had me at Nancy Drew.
And this conversation recorded live on GetVocal.com. And we have a weekly slot, Thursday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern. And in this episode, we talked with Shayna about the Black Dahlia.
So we're sure you're going to enjoy the interview. And if you want to pick up Shayna's book, Cold Cases, a True Crime Collection, you can simply search that at Amazon.com or just on your Google machine and make sure you pick that up.
Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Thursday night. It's Crawl Space Live. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. What's up, Lance?
Oh, feels good. You know what? The town clock has struck 9 bells this evening, which always brings me joy. It always brings me joy. It's Thursday night. It's the one consistent thing that's been just a beacon in the night in this horrible year, this 2020. The only thing you can depend on is Thursday night, True Crime Thursday on Get Vocal. If you listen, you can hear the church bells toll 9 p.m.
We've already got requests for you to not do the English accent in the chat room.
Because it's too much. I understand.
I'm a little worked up, too, though, already, because last week we were shut down abruptly. We had some technical difficulties, but we want to thank and welcome back author Shayna Roth to our airwaves, author of Cold Cases. How's it going, Shayna?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you guys doing?
Can't be better. Yeah, can't be better. That book that Tim's holding up right there, that is a fantastic book. Cold Cases, a True Crime Collection. We're going to get into that, but tell us a little bit about yourself. What do? You are in radio, you're a writer, an occasional backpacker from what I've read.
Yeah, I try and do as much as possible. My husband tells me my ego is wrapped up in being busy for some reason. I don't know where that came from, but that is me. So right now I'm actually working in print. I'm a former public radio reporter. I used to cover politics. I covered the 2016 election for Michigan's NPR stations, as well as, you know, everything else that was going on in 2016. You think 2020 is weird. 2016, the year we thought was going to be the craziest year ever. And now we're in 2020. We know better. So I did that for a few years. And now I work for MLive, which is a Michigan newspaper and an online site. I cover the environment right now statewide. And yeah, I, in my spare time, wrote a book about a year ago is when I started it. And it's based on a number of cold cases that I came across and sort of worked with my publisher to figure out what cold cases we wanted to talk about. But I was approached by Ulysses Press to write the book because I also have a former life as a prosecuting attorney. I was a prosecuting attorney for a little over a year in a small Michigan county called Ionia County. Didn't love it. It wasn't quite for me. It takes a very special type of person to do that on a daily basis. And I was not that type of person. And so I became a journalist. And so the book kind of combines that experience as a prosecutor with my experience as a journalist and is littered with my sarcasm. And I just really wanted it to feel like you were sitting down and having a coffee with a good friend and talking about some of really interesting cases.
Well, before we get into that, I'm actually surprised that Tim didn't cut you off when you said NPR. He doesn't like NPR. He doesn't
hate it.
No, he hates it. He is lobbying the government to pull funding. He thinks
defund it.
Defund NPR. And yeah, he doesn't see the use for it. And he's like, they're so smarmy. He used the word smarmy.
I mean, you know, there's probably some reporters, you know, there's some in every bunch. But, you know, I don't worry. I got out of there while the getting out was good.
Well, and luckily, most of that is not true. Just the part about them being smarmy. They're definitely smarmy.
I tried my best to really tone down my smarm while I was on the radio. I don't know how often I succeeded, but I tried my best.
Well, I will say your book is excellent. I love how, I mean, really, you've done a ton of research on each of these chapters, each of the stories you cover. So each chapter is a different cold case, and you really run the gamut because you cover art crime as well with the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, and that is how we know you, how we got to know you through Empty Frames, that our art crime show.
Yeah, I really wanted for the book to be about more than murder. You know, when I was talking with my editor, you know, there were a few cases that they really wanted to include, you know, some popular ones like JonBenet Ramsey and the Black Dahlia. But I wanted to make sure that, you know, there was a little bit of lightness in there. You know, not all crime is murder. In fact, most crimes do not involve assault or murder of any kind. So I wanted to include that. And, you know, as we discussed about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, I mean, that's just an amazing art heist that I wanted to include. And then there was, of course, D.B. Cooper. And, you know, the rest of it tends to be, you know, either disappearances or serial murders or individual murders. But yeah, I wanted to kind of have a broad spectrum of different types of cold cases included.
What was sort of the most daunting one that you took on? Because you just mentioned you had JonBenet Ramsey, you have D.B. Cooper, you have one on the Golden State Killer, the Zodiac. Was there anyone that you were like, wow, that is that's so like the Zodiac? Like, were you expecting to uncover something about the Zodiac? You know, like, what was the most daunting thing? Did you feel, here's my question, did you feel the need to say something new about the Zodiac?
I felt the need to say something new about all of them. And I will confess that when I started like researching, I started with the Zodiac and researching that one, I had like a whiteboard and I was like, I'm going to solve this. I got this. I'm going to figure this out. It's going to be fine. And I was like writing the codes on the thing. And then it took me like a day and I'm like, no, this is, there's a reason that nobody has cracked this. This is not going to happen. But it was a very, like, especially the Zodiac was a very daunting chapter because there's been so much about podcasts. There's umpteen million movies. There's books. And so what I tried to focus on for each of these cases was not so much about like, okay, I need to like find a new fact or, you know, like uncover, you know, new evidence in these cases, but really it was more about what is a fresh perspective that I can bring to these cases that most people have probably heard about multiple times. So I tried to come up with different themes that I would notice as I was doing my research. So I really wanted to do the Cleveland Torso murders because I was really drawn to the fact that Elliot Ness did not die the, you know, Kevin Costner in The Untouchables heartthrob that I had assumed he had. It turned out that he died, you know, an alcoholic, broke at his kitchen sink, feeling like a complete failure. And so, you know, it was things like that that I was uncovering as I was working on these cases that I thought, okay, you know, here's something that might deserve to be elevated, or here's something that I could put some sort of a fresh perspective on.
Yeah, for sure. Now, it's funny you mentioned the Elliot Ness thing, because that's something that stood out to me. I watched the movie The Untouchables so many times as a kid, and they leave you with that perception of Elliot Ness. Like, he put away Al Capone. It was this, like, historic moment in crime history, and he rode off in the sunset and was probably given accommodations, but that's not the case. He was a severely tortured and alcoholic and broken human being.
Yeah, I mean, he rode off into Cleveland and thinking he was going to be, you know, like their sort of top cop in the area. He was going to, you know, fix the traffic problems and, you know, do some other, you know, just like, oh, I'm here for the good of the people stuff. And that's not what happened. Instead, he got dumped into a place that was, you know, overrun with poverty. You know, it was in a very bad situation, and it just so happened that somebody started chopping up bodies and throwing them all over the place. And that was eventually his problem to try and solve. And the fact that he couldn't is incredibly tragic. And, you know, it's one of the things that I wanted to kind of continually focus on in each of these chapters was the victims, and to make sure that, you know, their voices on some level were heard and that they weren't just treated as props. And in that chapter, I really saw him as being one of the victims, because it just completely destroyed his life, his inability to solve that case.
Well, I would say you definitely achieved honoring the victim in the case of the Black Dahlia, the chapter on her, because it really, really kind of stands out. You really dug into that. You really kind of tried to take away the nickname in a way, in a sense. You know, I almost didn't want to use it tonight after I read that chapter.
Ah, mission accomplished. Yeah. I mean, that one was one where I found myself like really ended up passionate about that case.
That's really funny that Tim said that, because before we started the show, he was like, I'm going to use that Black Dahlia line over and over and over until her head pops. So I think it's funny that he did a 180 again. I'm totally kidding. I'm totally kidding. Go on. And I interrupted. I'm going to mute myself.
This is a conversation. I'm into it. No, but the Black Dahlia chapter, I think that was definitely one where I felt myself becoming very personally invested in it, because the more I read especially the media coverage of it at the time, the newspaper articles about Elizabeth Short and about what had happened to her, it felt so demeaning, and it felt like her essence had really been taken away from her. She was not treated as an individual person. She was treated as, you know, victim with like a lowercase v. It was just really difficult to see her having to have gone through that after she had died. You know, she was a very complete person. And unfortunately, there's not a ton known about her as an individual. So I took it as, you know, sort of my job to do the best that I could in the time that I had to really give her some sort of a voice and to try and discourage people from going forward, from treating victims in that way, as though they are just these sort of props in these gruesome, macabre stories. Mm-hmm.
And how much research did you do per chapter? Like, how many articles did you? Yeah, because you cite like I think up to like 90 articles, I feel like, in a certain chapter. Yeah, how many, how long did it take you to research for a chapter?
It took quite a bit. Newspapers.com, I'm constantly like giving them a shout out. I would love to be their new spokeswoman because they were that's an incredible website. I mean, if you're ever just bored and are curious about, you know, what a case or coverage of anything. I mean, it's pretty user friendly. So I combed through a lot of their archives, a lot of their newspapers. There's a few of these cases are so old and so well known that the FBI has released their their documents online. So, I did a lot of combing through different archival police reports and things like that. So how much research? I mean, it was a lot. I'll just say that. I mean, the book from when I signed the contract to when I sent them the final draft was about a year, which, talking with other people is kind of like, they only gave you a year? Like, that's insane. But it worked out really well. But yeah, a lot of that was spent doing the research and kind of taking it one chapter at a time and just sitting down and, going through everything, highlighting and making notes. And then when I got to a certain place where I felt like, okay, I think I've got a handle on this, is when I would sit down and start like interpreting it in my voice and sort of writing through that chapter.
That's pretty cool. Interesting process. I'm surprised to know that in your chapter on Elizabeth Shore, in your research, it didn't come up that my grandmother and Elizabeth Shore were actually roommates for a period of time in Medford, Massachusetts.
I can't tell if you're being serious or not.
I am actually being very serious.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I unfortunately don't know much about it other than that. In reading your chapter on her, it must have been after, I think she had gone to Florida for a while and then before she went to California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It is such a small world.
Yeah.
So how did you find out about that? Like, did she tell you about that? Or was it like family lore?
She was arrested for the murder briefly.
Okay, that makes sense.
They interrogated her for a little bit, but she passed the polygraph.
No, it's just kind of like, I feel like it was just known in my family. My mom, and she has six sisters, so they were big into crime stories. So that was just kind of like known in the family, but I didn't really, I never really knew anything else about it. And I'm not really, I guess I could ask some of my aunts now to see if there's anything more to that.
Small world.
Yeah.
Very small world. I thought for sure you were going to be like, actually, she did in fact kill the black. I mean, because there's just so many people.
She
could have. That was one of the crazy things about writing this book.
Shut up, Liz.
I'm pretty sure my grandmother never even went to California. So no, she couldn't have.
Well, I mean, do we really know our grandmothers?
Exactly.
Well, let me just say, though, my grandfather, her husband, his nickname was Red. Just like one of the suspects in the black.
This is something we might murder. Need to take offline.
But I think we got to do some digging here is what I'm hearing.
But it wasn't that fellow, the fellow who was suspected.
tell her about your uncle, Al DeSalvo.
Albert DeSalvo. Yeah.
Uncle Al.
Actually, my mom met Albert DeSalvo.
Oh yeah,
that
Uncle
is
Chokey.
True. Yeah, she did. She did meet him briefly. She was like introduced to him. She, her friend. Yeah, this is crazy. We're going through all my family true crime folklore tonight.
Wow. I have one. My dad shook O.J. Simpson's hand one time.
Before or after?
Yeah, when?
As far as I know, it was before. It was when he was in football. My dad somehow was out of practice or something, and he shook his hand. And that was one of the big things when that case came out. He's like, I shook that guy's hand. And I'm just, like, what are you talking about? What's going on?
Oh, I wanted it to be that he shook his hand on set of The Naked Gun.
Like, oh, no, unfortunately, no.
Good performance, sir. No.
Well, it is weird when you have like personal kind of brushes with, like a major case like that, it kind of, it is interesting. And really, Elizabeth Short's case, I find compelling too. And you go through a lot of the suspects in there. Were there any that really kind of stuck out to you as being more likely?
Not really. That was one of those cases where like happened in quite a few of them, where just like randos would come out of the woodwork and be like, it was me, I did it. And then you find out they're crazy or they want attention. So it was, yeah, it was one of those cases where that happened so much that I think it really drowned out any ability to kind of find like who could have possibly actually done it. You know, there's a lot of theories about that case. There's, you know, theories that she knew the person. There's theories that, you know, it was the doctor. For whatever reason, I don't find any of them to be extremely compelling. I think that particularly for a case like that, where they've been cold for so long, we just have to accept the fact that we're just not going to find the answer to this. Because if we were able to, we probably would have by now. But that's the pessimist in me, so.
But I like that you kind of make the case for a serial killer in the chapter. And I think it's really an astute observation. And I think that's pretty likely.
Yeah, I mean, based on what we know now, or think we know now about serial murders, it has a lot of those hallmarks of it. And, you know, there were other women at the time who, you know, had these events, you know, who were murdered in not exactly the same way. But I think that if they had that sort of language and that understanding at the time that there could be, you know, some psychopath out there killing multiple people of this of sort of similar situations, I think that would have been something that they definitely would have explored. But, you know, it was just that's one of the interesting things about law enforcement and about solving crimes is like there's a continual evolution of it. And unfortunately, I think that the case was probably so long ago that we probably can't definitively come up with an answer, even using today's new technology. But I think that if this had happened, you know, even 20, 30 years after it did, we probably could have figured it out.
And Shiloh in the chat room, who works in Los Angeles, adjacent to law enforcement at least, try to be vague, I'm not, but she says that Hodel was totally a serial murderer. And Hodel was, I believe, one of the suspects sort of outed by his son, which is a very bizarre little twist.
Yeah, that happened a couple times. There was Hodel said that his dad did it. There was another woman who said that her dad did it. And I think Hodel is an interesting study. Not Hodel the accused individual, but Hodel the son who keeps accusing this, because his, you know, his sort of backstory of being a cop, and then sort of like, oh no, I discovered that my dad did it, is, you know, if it's true, is bananas. But I tend to be one of those people where if I hear hoofbeats, I think horses, not zebras. So I think that if it's so crazy like that, I tend to be very skeptical of it. But, you know, I mean, he does have some interesting arguments for it. You know, some of the people that I spoke with, even after the book was finished, you know, they're very, very skeptical of Hodel. You know, they just don't think that he's got, you know, that he's, you know, making a lot of stretches and he's drawing a lot of conclusions that don't quite fit. But I think that the more interesting character in all of that is the son and sort of what his, because now he's, you know, he's selling more books. He has the sequel. Correct me if I'm wrong. I feel like he also said that his dad was the Zodiac. Or was responsible for something else. Somebody else in the chat, help me out here.
Yes.
He was he like under suspicion for murder a couple of years before the Black Dahlia? Before?
He went to trial for what we now know to be essentially molestation. So, I mean, he was clearly a very bad person. But I don't know that he was actually ever suspected of murder.
Well, it really is a fascinating part. And Shiloh says that she knows Steve, the junior.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe Shiloh should pop on here and tell us about it.
Yeah, pop on.
I would love to hear. I'm so fascinated by him. I would love to hear more.
Yeah, that really is interesting to have the conviction, I guess, to say that you think your dad might have been this, you know, the murderer of this famous victim. Shiloh, how's it going?
Good.
What's up, Shiloh?
I don't feel like this is my story to tell at all, though. But yeah, we did a panel with Steve last year. And so Scott and I kind of got to know him through that. And he and I have remained pretty close. And I am like halfway through one book of his seven or whatever, because they're so dense. But yeah, she's right. He does also make the leap that his dad is responsible for the Zodiac killings. So kind of crazy.
What's he like in person when he's like explaining these connections? Cause I feel like I, for me at least, I was like, okay, I could get on board with like, maybe your dad's the black, killed Elizabeth Short. Mm-hmm. It's when he's like, oh, but he also killed the Zodiac. It's like, what, like how, I guess, how legit does he feel when you talk to him?
So I have always told him when I sit down and talk with him that I actually want to read through the books and read through all of it rather than having him trying to explain it to me in a like hour conversation. So I haven't even gone there yet verbally with him. But I call him like my adopted grandpa, and that I have adopted him as like, hey, just, he's wonderful to sit down and talk with. And, we've gone to lunch a couple of times and just sort of told me about, you know, talking about his career in law enforcement at LAPD and working homicide. And it tracks with all the other law enforcement officers that I've ever worked with. He had a very eclectic upbringing. So just with his dad's uniqueness. But he's, you know, very, very interesting guy. And it's become a relationship that I really value. I would love for the case to be solved, you know, while he is still alive. That would be amazing. And he also wants that too, whether it's his dad or not. So
still like examining and working on the case and looking for different angles and new evidence and things like that.
There is evidence that is there that investigators aren't interested in, according to him. So, and I understand the politics of the big departments and how, you know, to me, it's just mind blowing. Like, why wouldn't a department want to solve the oldest, you know, most popular high profile cold case in Los Angeles? Like, do it right now. Maybe that'll take the heat off of you for other things. but I do understand that there are politics behind it. And people get really territorial over cases, and it's still technically an open case in Los Angeles. Like, there is a homicide detective that has that case assigned to them. So, it's pretty interesting. I mean, he took all of the evidence he uncovered to the district attorney at the time, you know, a couple, maybe 15 years ago. And the district attorney said, if your dad was alive, I would file on him right now. So, and I have copies of all those documents that he gave to the district attorney.
Does he ever come across as like super fringy or edgy or anything? Because I was just reading into it, you don't even have to like look into him very deeply before you see that he's suspected his father of being the lipstick killer, the Zodiac, something about the Jigsaw murderer.
Well, those are all the serial killings that she was talking about, like all within the same time period in Los Angeles. So, I mean, yeah, they were all happening around the same time. I think Wondery did a really good podcast on like all of those killings that were happening at the same time. I can't remember what it's called, but it might just be titled The Black Dahlia Murders, plural. But no, I mean, one-on-one, he doesn't come off as fringy, you know, but it's a lot to digest. It really is. But also cool to think about, you know, you're like, well, what if, you know, what if? That would be so crazy.
Does he ever give like an impression of regret or maybe shame, I guess, is what I'm trying to say? Like, don't, this is my dad. Don't look at me the same way.
No, I don't think. You know, he has a very good sense of self where it's not as if, you know, those two things have been put together. He has other brothers as well. You know, it's not like it is a very interesting family. And we know that from like the Root of Evil podcast and the TV show that was done and all of that. But it seems like it, like his generation, you know, people did pretty well and weren't as dysfunctional.
You keep mentioning these other podcasts, as if you listen to anything else besides Crawl Space and Missing Maura Murray and Empty Frames. You must be told information about these podcasts, right?
Well, you know what's weird is I know that you stole your guest from Rebecca, and I know that's a thing you guys do. So, it's, but at least that's Crawl Space, right? I mean,
what?
We do not
go. Stolen, I came willingly.
Yeah.
We do not steal guests from Rebecca Sebastian. We simply go to her website and we look at her past shows and we say, oh, those are interesting guests. And we listen to the interviews and we say they're very fun. You know, they're very knowledgeable and they make for great interviews. And it's more like a tribute.
Hey, Crawlspace community. Do you love true crime podcasts but could do without all the chatty banter? Are you intrigued by what's underneath our collective true crime obsession and want to hear field experts, authors, and content creators weigh in on the subject? Well, it might be time for you to kill the small talk and join the dialogue. I'm Rebecca Sebastian, host of Dialogue, a true crime conversation, which is a weekly podcast where I speak with fascinating guests from the true crime world and the criminal justice system. And yes, I have interviewed Tim and Lance, and you don't want to miss that episode. Together, we explore the genre itself and attempt to answer the why of true crime and the question, what are we even talking about when we talk about true crime? Join me every Wednesday for a new episode and a killer conversation. Dialogue is part of the Crawl Space Network and available wherever you listen.
I noticed that you have a Nancy Drew book.
I do.
Strategically positioned behind you. Yeah, so you were a Nancy Drew fan. Was it just strictly Nancy Drew, or did the little like Hardy Boys get in there?
I read a few Hardy Boys, but I mean, Nancy was my girl. I grew up just constantly consuming Nancy Drew books. And this was just one that like I found in my parents' basement a few years ago and was like, oh, well, I need to have that and have to display it prominently everywhere I go. But yeah, no, I mean, that's I've been a lover of mysteries for probably even since I was a kid. I think my initial, I really wanted to just solve mysteries. And I think that was part of the reason why I wanted to become a lawyer, is because I thought that there was some level of mystery solving. I'm like, I don't think I can make it as a cop. You know, they got to drive around a lot and I don't know how to get from point A to point B. And I don't know, that just seems like people yell at you all the time. And then I found out that people yell at lawyers all the time too. And I was very disappointed. But yeah, no, I absolutely grew up loving Nancy Drew.
That's crazy. Do you know when that book was written? In the 30s.
Yeah. And it turns out I recently found out that, because it's been a while since I read like the original versions of them, that they had to go through and make a few changes because apparently the original 1930s weren't super PC on some things. And so they kind of went through and made a few light edits.
She was just ahead of her time.
Behind her times now.
Oh, gotcha.
Well, I do want to talk about Amber Hagerman too, and really how the Amber Alert came to be was that case, which I found very interesting reading in your book.
Yeah, that one was. I really wanted to include a chapter that had that kind of had some sort of a, you know, I guess not a silver lining, because there's still a dead child at the end of the day, but that shows that, you know, occasionally something good can come from terrible, terrible things. And the Amber Alert case was exactly that, where you had this, you know, really remarkably terrible, tragic event that happened. But the result of it was a woman was, you know, watching the coverage on TV and got an idea. And speaking with her was really interesting, because, you know, she was just a very normal person. She's, I believe, a massage therapist. And it was just one of those things where I think a lot of true crime enthusiasts, there's a case that gets to them. I think her story is very real for a lot of people, where she saw, you know, the coverage of it, and she just was so drawn in, and she just could not let it go. She just, you know, kept thinking about the case and thinking about it and just being like, I want to be able to do something And she actually did. And it's absolutely remarkable. And that was a really hard chapter for me to write. I think that for personal reasons was probably, you had asked earlier, sort of the most difficult one. I think that one personally was the most difficult one because I was like 6 months pregnant when I started working on that chapter. And so I had a few nightmares and I had a few cries and, but yeah, I thought that that case really was something that I don't think a lot of people think about. You know, I think people are familiar with Amber Alerts, you know, they blow up our phone every now and then, but you know, the backstory to that I think is really remarkable.
Can I ask where those tears came from? If you don't mind sharing, what about that, brought that reaction?
Yeah. I'm a bit of a crier anyway, you know, like I read my daughter, The Lorax, and like I cry at the end of it every time because it's so sweet. I'm like, the trees, we got to save the trees. But no, for me, it was this reaction of like, oh my God, I'm bringing a kid into the world and she's not going to be safe. Like there's just nothing, there's just nowhere to hide. And how can I be doing this? And then I, you know, kind of took a couple breaths and I started looking into and that kind of got me looking into like statistics and things like that. And that's why I wanted to include a section in the book that kind of talks about how, you know, how rare these types of kidnappings are, that, you know, really people are safe majoritively, and that, you know, a lot of times crime happens between people that, you know, or, you know, is done by somebody that, you know, particularly crimes against children. And that kind of helped in some ways, was like a bit of a therapy for me, helped reassure me that, you know, the world is going to be an okay place for her. But yeah, but a lot of it was just, you know, just the thought of somebody taking a child was just really rough for me, and always, but especially, you know, sort of in that heightened circumstance.
Yeah. And her case is still unsolved. Is this something that you, you know, when you were covering it as part of your book, did you ever consider maybe making this into a larger scale book or a larger scale project because it affected you the way it did?
I hadn't, you know, I've thought about sort of, you know, what are some other projects that I could do, you know, sort of after this one kind of, you know, settles down. And I think that would definitely be one of them that might be worth kind of digging into a bit more and seeing, you know, what else is out there, about that case. The other one is probably the Freeway Phantom, where I thought, you know, this is a case that I'm, you know, really deserves kind of like that full scale, like podcast treatment type thing. I mean, I think that would be a really interesting, you know, similar to the Atlanta Murders podcast that came out, or Empty Frames, the only podcast,
yes,
I listen to.
Exactly.
you know, I think that one is definitely you know, there's so much to the Freeway Phantom, you know, that you've got the culture at the time, you've got, you know, more discussion deserves about who these little girls were. You know, I think there's just so much there, that really it deserves more than what it got, because really that's a case that I had difficulty finding information on. You know, I had to, don't tell the DC library, but I had to steal a friend's library card because, you know, her mom's like,
oh my God, you just said that it's on Twitter, it's on Facebook, it is on YouTube.
This is streaming live.
This is just between us, right?
No,
right?
We can't edit this.
No!
Chase.
There's 100,000 people listening to this.
At least.
The DC library is going to come for me. They're coming for me. I can hear the sirens already.
Oh, no. Alice is calling the FBI.
Oh, no. Alice, come on.
Oh, geez. Well, you know what, Tim? You know what I'm hearing here is a pitch for a show on the Crawl Space Media Network, and I'm totally down with this. I think this would make a great show on the Crawl Space Media Network.
You already have the experience behind the microphone.
And the library card, so.
And the library card. We'll workshop this offline, but I'm dead serious.
I'm into it. I that's one of those cases where I just, you know, there was a few of them, but as I was writing this book, I'm like, there's just not, they gave me like 7,000 words and I'm like, I need more. There's too much here that really deserves to be looked into and told. And I'm just, that's one of, I've kept all my stuff on that one. I just kind of keep eyeing that pile in my office. Like we gotta work on that a little bit more.
Yeah, some of the murders that we cover are so disturbing, and Molly Bish is one that comes to mind that really disturbed me. Similar to what you were kind of saying about how Amber's case disturbed you, and I wonder sometimes if we're really not that safe. Like, is it worth it feeling less safe in doing this work? Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I think it's gotta be, right? Because you're more aware now, like the bad guys are still the same amount, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've kind of, shorn up my defenses when I was a prosecutor, and then I went and I married a prosecutor who is still, now he's an assistant U.S. attorney. So I spent the last, however many years we've been together, every day coming home, and I'd be like, what'd you work on today? And hearing about, he used to do murders, he used to do rapes, he used to do like just really, really difficult cases. And, we would talk through them, and he'd talk me through his, before trial, we talked through these things. So I had really developed a sort of, like a shored up armor when it comes to talking about these cases. It gets a little bit different though. I felt when I was working on the book, when I'm like deep into it, when it's more than just a conversation, when it's like, I am reading through all of the police reports and I'm reading through the news coverage and I'm looking and I'm watching all of the documentaries. Like, you just become so consumed by these cases, and it does get difficult. It does get really tricky. I think that the way that I sort of work through that is having a sense of humor, and realizing that, this stuff's going to happen, whether I find a way to joke or not. And the other thing too, is just, I'm very open about the fact that, I speak to a therapist, and like, I am very aware of my mental health. And that's something that I've done sort of progressively throughout, when I was in college through even today. I think there's different things that you can do to really ensure that you're protecting yourself while you are working on very difficult cases like this.
Yeah, you see a lot of people who just get burnt out. We've seen that numerous times when we've covered Maura Murray's case. People just dive in because they love the mystery. They love untangling that knot, and they think they can do it. And I mean, you kind of said it with the cases that you covered in your book. You're not going to solve something like someone looking into it just as a hobby most likely will not solve something that has gone unsolved for 15, 20, 25 years. And then you see people, I guess, fall into this abyss of, they didn't understand that this was like actual reality, and it's actually dark, and there's a spectrum of psychosis that you have to become aware of. And you're right, the sense of humor helps. Tim and I have recently learned about this spectrum of psychosis, which goes, it runs the gamut from like narcissism to like full-blown psychopath, and then there's the Machiavellianism and all of this stuff. And it's like, I think Heather Bish said something when she was on with us to the effect of, it would be nice if something about like, it'd be nice if it was just one bad guy. It'd be nice if you caught, one bad, like, and that he was responsible for that. Or, and it's, the reality is that there's so many types of bad guys out there. And
she was hoping that Molly's killer and Holly Perinian,
right,
her killer were the same, because she doesn't think they are, and they're two young girls who were murdered around the same area around the same time. And it's a lot harder to rationalize or realize that it's probably two different people.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to it's easy to, for two, in two ways. I mean, it's easy to kind of see, sort of the vague outlines of a case and go, oh, that's interesting, I'm curious, and just jump in. And then it becomes really easy to lose yourself into it. Because I think that humans are naturally curious, particularly humans that are interested in true crime. We're curious. We want to know what happened, and human nature requires some sense of finality. You know, we want closure. We want to know what happened in these cases. And I think that sometimes it becomes difficult to pull yourself back and to take a step back and be like, you know what, we might just not get that sense of closure, and I just have to be okay with it. Can I ask, what is going on with the honey? I'm so curious.
Sorry, oh, yeah, the chat room is a lot of times on a different plane.
I'm sorry to just completely break it up. I just keep seeing like honey, somebody's buying honey. How much is the honey?
I've been on the brink of laughing just from some of the comments in the chat room through some real serious topics that we're actually having on the air. So yeah, unrelated.
It's kind of tough.
But this is the honey. This is Lance's company, and that's his dog.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, we just had our first round of selling honey from the hives in Salem, Massachusetts. This is a brand new venture that I started to do, and we use Tim's chugging it. My dog Eric is the CEO of the company, and he sort of runs the operations. And yeah, people just started recently receiving their honey that was sold out. So I see Esther and Brock. Let's get your addresses offline, and we'll send you a couple of bottles. And Shane, if you want a bottle of honey as well.
Yeah, I'm
a honey enthusiast. I have honey sticks currently in my pantry. I would love some more honey. So yes, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll grab your address offline, or if you just want to give it live right here. You've already spilled the tea on the library card theft. So, which actually
difficult as possible for them to find me.
Right.
So you stole a library card,
and you
I stole the library card number.
Okay. And you covered the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist.
Ooh, I see where you're going with this.
I'm not making definitive connections here, but I would like to know where you were at March 18th, 1990.
I'm going to have to plead the fifth, sir.
Well, okay. That sounds like an admission of guilt. I think we have solved Isabella Stewart Museum heist. Who knew?
Well, I have a kind of a fun question for you. You cover a lot of crime. You've read a lot of crime books. You've written a lot about crime. What is your favorite or a standout adaptation of a true crime story that is made like, you know, a TV series or a movie?
Oh, that's a great question. Standout for being good or standout for being bad?
Ooh, I was thinking good, but let's do both.
Because the Black Dahlia, I think it was called Black Dahlia, the one with Hilary Swank was just exceptional. And I think Josh Hartnett was in that one too. That one is just an exceptionally terrible movie. Really disappointing. As far as a really good one, oh God, I don't know why I'm having trouble thinking of one off the top of my head. What do you guys like?
For true crime adaptation, I mean, Zodiac, it doesn't get much better than Zodiac. Zodiac's great.
The David Fincher one. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Nope. Yeah. That's got to be it, right?
Yeah.
That one's just an incredible movie. That's for me is peak Robert Downey Jr. I mean, forget yeah. Iron Man. I mean, he is fantastic in that movie.
Oh, he plays such a great character. His character is Paul Avery, right? Like he plays that character so well. One of the best scenes is towards the end when he's in the bar and he sees, you know, Robert Graysmith on the news, and he just has that one line where he's just like fucking library, and it's so well, it's one of the best lines in the whole movie. It's so good. You know what's shocking about the Black Dahlia movie is that Brian De Palma made it, and it's so bad.
I know. When I was working on this, I was like, oh, I think I missed that one. And so I'm like, oh, Brian De Palma, this is probably going to be really great. How did I miss it the first time around? And then I watched it, and I was just like, what are we doing here, people? What happened? Who hurt you? Why is this happening?
God, what? Very random. I don't think we've ever mentioned Brian De Palma on a Get Vocal or in any one of our shows, and we've already mentioned two of his movies tonight.
What was the other one?
Untouchables.
Oh, duh. That's right. See, he's really hit or miss, right?
He
like, that's
really
a great
is
movie.
Miss.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are just way on the other end of the spectrum. That's too bad.
Black Dahlia was so disappointing. I'm with you there. I remember being very excited for that movie when it came out.
Yeah, and it really played into the whole, like, this, you know, we're treating her as some sort of, like, weird sexist object kind of a thing. It was just, it just got so nuts. And, yeah, no.